Welcome to the Heights Podcast. At Heights, our mission is to love and to lead all people to a new life with Christ. This episode is part two of my conversation with my brother, Dr. Dan Hogan, about the gospel and film. Dan is a college professor who teaches screenwriting. If you would like to hear part one of this conversation, be sure to check out the previous episode. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, and I think that, again, good art often asks questions. Bad art often tends to jump right to the answer. Mm-hmm. Good art invites those kinds of discussions. And one of my favorite pieces of good art from the last year or so just won the 7 Academy Awards. And that is Oppenheimer. The other half of the Barbenheimer phenomenon.
That's right, because they were released and marketed together.
Yes, they were released and marketed together. Well, it was the internet did it because they were different studios. Right. But it was a fascinating point of view where when it came down to it, both of them made a lot of money and both of them got a lot of awards attention, though Barbie made more money and Oppenheimer won more Oscars.
Right.
Which is like, hey, they both win. But what I thought was interesting about Oppenheimer was that it invited, again, layers, but it didn't necessarily tell the viewers what to think about J. Robert Oppenheimer. Hmm. And one of the things that I dislike about movies that are based on a true story is when they give you like a real one-sided view of historical character, because mm-hmm. the thing is, historical characters are not one-sided. Nobody's one-sided.
Right. People are complicated.
People are complicated. History is really complicated. And the story of Oppenheimer is complicated. Two people can see the movie, and I've seen reviewers who said, I hated Oppenheimer. He was awful. And other people were like, Oppenheimer was a hero. And they're both right.
Interesting.
And similarly, if you read your Bible, every single Bible character does some things that are great and does some things that are terrible. Well, some of them just do terrible things. But yeah. a lot of biblical characters do great things and do terrible things. And sometimes there's debate and questions about, well, what's great and what's terrible. And I saw some of the same themes coming through loud and clear when it comes to Oppenheimer. Because this is a story about a man who created the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is an invention that is wrought with conflict. And like, if you're not ambivalent about the atomic bomb, I don't know what to tell you. Because mm-hmm. on one hand, you know, there are, you know, World War II. I am happy that the Allies won World War II. But man, did a lot of people have to die for that to happen.
Right.
And that is a tremendous question that the movie asks. Was it worth it? Mm-hmm. You know, was there another way? Is it worth, you know, having this power, you know, being able to split the atom, being able to wipe people out in the blink of an eye? What do you do with that kind of power? Who is responsible enough to wield that kind of power? Mm-hmm. You know, that is a wonderful, terrible question that the movie does a good job asking. And then, I mean, that's just, and the movie doesn't tell you what to think about that.
That's something I kind of appreciate, because that's a movie that could have been very political.
I mean, yes, I mean, it still is.
Yeah.
But it's more political in the sense of asking a question rather than giving you the answer.
Right. And because I think it's a complicated issue.
Correct.
And it's because you're dealing with now, I mean, we're going on what, about 80 years of living in the nuclear, the atomic age, where nuclear weapons and the threat of a nuclear conflict is still a thing that we deal with. I feel like it's not something that we've talked about. Or it's something that I think we didn't talk about for a long time. I think recently, with some of the conflict that's been going on between Russia and Ukraine, some of those questions are being asked again But for a long time, but you know, but the reality, the reason why we didn't talk about it for several decades, I think, is because we've kind of reached a, I mean, politically speaking, world superpowers have kind of reached a standstill, you know,
yes,
where it's,
with the end of the Cold War, you know, with the fall of the Soviet Union, a lot of the questions about sort of imminent nuclear threat kind of subsided, or at least went dormant up until very recently, where now people are with global conflict, the question of, you know, are nuclear weapons going to become involved is now very much front of mind.
Right.
But beyond the sort of the philosophical geopolitical messages about Oppenheimer, one of the things that was also interesting to me was this: the movie itself is about a man of great genius and great talent, and about what he chooses to do with that talent, and about how his moral failings and his judgment influence how he uses the talent. So half of the movie is about building a bomb. The other half of the movie has to do with his security clearance, all right, and his involvement with the government. This has to do with lies he told, or truths he didn't quite tell all of, and also a particular affair he had with someone he was not married to, and the political associations that she had, and his involvement with her, and, you know, how much of his sort of cloak and dagger clandestine movements was about him, you know, whether or not he was involved with the communists, whether or not he was lying to the government for that, or whether or not he was lying to the government because he was sleeping with someone who was not his wife.
He was sneaking around on his spouse. Yeah.
That is a wonderful cautionary tale. His life would be significantly simpler if he was not having an affair with someone he was not married to. It would be a lot shorter movie. we'd have the hour and a half version of it if it was about that. And, you know, it reminded me of some of the great men in, I mean, great with air quotes, if you will, men in the Bible. King David. He is a man after God's own heart who is involved in a sex scandal where his lies and his murders, he lies and murders in order to cover up a sex scandal. And how much of, and which results in the collapse of his dynasty, where it is brother against brother, and his family house crumbles because of his moral failings. You know, and then you have guys like Solomon. You know, I think of Oppenheimer, who can do physics that no one had ever done before. And I think of Solomon with all the wisdom in the world. And what did he do with it? What did he do with it? He glorified himself. He got involved with, you know, however many thousands of wives and concubines he had, that he spent it on frivolous pleasures and honored himself rather than honoring the God who gave him his talent. Oppenheimer, in many ways, is a cautionary tale about what are you going to do with the talent, with the gifts that God has given you? Are you going to please yourself? Are you going to please your government? Are you going to honor God with it? And it doesn't necessarily answer what the right answer is.
Right.
Is building the atomic bomb, was that the right move? I don't know, and neither does the book, or does the movie. But asking that kind of question of ourselves as believers is important. Are we honoring God with what he's given us?
That's a good take. You know, the saying goes that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Which probably is a good transition to my favorite movie recently, Dune 2.
Nice. Oh, so you got
here's my sandworm for my background. Okay. We are going back to planet Arrakis, where the spice must flow, and may thy knife chip and shatter.
That was a great movie.
It was a great movie.
It was two great movies.
It was two great movies. So, Dune is a very interesting film as well, though, because it, in many ways, it is a another one of those cautionary tales. Because Dune, it is about, it's about power, really. It is about how to get it, who gets it, how to hang on to it, and what do you do with it once you get it. So this, the premise of Dune is there is this large galactic empire, and they control this resource called spice on the desert planet. And the agents of the empire are warring over it. Spoiler alert, all of history is people warring over scarce resources.
So is this, and then at this point in the story, C-3PO and R2-D2, they crash land on the desert planet, and they find the boy, the farm boy who becomes a different movie.
Well, in many ways, different movie, in many ways, the same movie. But what you have there is that you have a guy like Paul Atreides, who is a young man who finds himself at this crossroads. Well, he has an opportunity to help defeat the evil Galactic Empire by allying himself with the Fremen, and he is uniquely positioned to wield power, to take up power and wield it. But the ultimate question is, what are you going to do with it? Will Paul become exactly the corrupt, tyrannical figure that he was initially trying to stop? And Dune is, with all of its sandworms and all of its space witches and all of its knife fights, ultimately about that question. Does power corrupt? Absolutely.
You know,
And
I
it
think,
doesn't necessarily answer the question either.
well, it doesn't in the movie. I think if you read the books, I think, and there's many books, and I think the books,
Yes.
I think, explore they continue to explore that theme.
And the books explore it over the course of thousands of years, because with
Right.
science fiction, then we can do this, that you can. You can write the next book, and it's like, well, then 1,000 years passed, and this is what happened. And in a successive with the, and they get weirder and weirder, and worms are involved. But the it was interesting to me to because I've read some of the books, not all of them, but I've read a few of them. It's interesting to me to see student or not students. Well, sorry, community college professor. I always default to calling everybody students, but it's interesting to see viewers see the film and they think, oh, wow, that Paul guy, he's great. I can't wait for him to beat the big bad emperor. And I'm like, very worried about this. And there were other people who said, I don't like this movie because this is, about this outsider who comes in and he saves the day, and that this is this sort of tired trope of this savior figure. And I was like, keep reading. Keep reading. If you don't like the idea of the savior figure, well, this is, and one of the things that I think of, again, tying it back to the Bible, you see elements of David. You see elements of these kinds of biblical figures. The one of the issues with David was that he and Solomon, they knew what the right thing was to do, but they didn't do it.
Right.
And part of what happens with Paul in Dune is partly because he has sort of supernatural powers due to his training and the spice, is that he sees the future. He sees the path. And it's a question of, well, he knows everything. And yet, is he going to do it anyway? Is he going to make the right decision anyway? And who, what decision is right? Is it right for his people? Is it right for him? How do you make that decision? And in many ways, you know, there is a lot of religious undertones to Dune, and many people will see Dune as a critique of organized religion, and they will say, "See, you're not supposed to follow religion because religion will lead to terrible wars." And yet, as a Christian, I'm not offended by Dune. And because part of it is that I see Paul Atreides. Timothy Chalamet is not Jesus.
Right.
And the message that I take is not, don't follow Jesus. The message I take away from Dune is, don't follow people who are not Jesus who say they are.
Right. Beware false prophets.
Beware of false prophets. Beware of people who will claim, to be speaking on behalf of God who are not God.
Right.
And the other thing too is you can know them by their fruit. You know, if your leader is asking you to do things that glorify God, wonderful. Like, that sounds like a good leader. If your leader is asking you to go to intergalactic war on his behalf, maybe you should think through whether or not you should be following that leader.
Yeah, you know, there's a huge amount of the New Testament that's devoted to this particular question, is how do you spot false teachers and how do you respond to them? You know, and I think so. What was fascinating to me about Dune, was that especially in the second movie, I was curious to see how they were going to handle the second half of the story, because I've read the first book. I watched the first movie before I read the book. Then I read the book this past year, and I finished the book just a little bit before the second movie came out. And I was curious to see how they were going to handle some of the religious aspects of the story, because I felt like those aspects were kind of downplayed in the first movie, or at least they weren't nearly as overt. And so
Yeah, I'd agree.
I wasn't sure if the second movie was going to be more of just the story of him fighting for the freedom of his people, or if they were going to dig into more of the religious conflict that's present in the book. And I was interested that they really, in the second movie, the religious conflict is really a big, is kind of the central conflict, because you have characters that are true believers that believe that Paul is the Messiah. He's the chosen one. He's the one who's been prophesied. And then there are characters that are very skeptical and really don't believe at all. And then there's characters that are kind of even aware of the fact that some of the prophecies are false prophecies. And so you have different characters kind of on a spectrum. And then you have Paul himself, who I think in the movie is very much a pragmatist, you know? And so you have people in his circle that believe he's the chosen one. And you have people in his circle that really believe he's not the chosen one. And then you have Paul himself, who's sort of like, well, but I have to do something. You know, and I have to sort of just do what is best for me and my people. And so it's how you're handling the question of like how the religion plays into the decisions that we're going to make and moving forward, I thought was really a centerpiece of a film.
Well, and to come back to Genesis 3, as I'm wont to do, so much of what the Bible is about, the story of the Bible, when we get to the original sin, which is taking the fruit of the tree, what it is it is humans have been told, this is the way it's supposed to be. God has given you one choice. Do this, they'll do that. And the humans, they look at that tree and they think, that tree looks pretty nice. That tree looks pretty nice. Looks good to me. In my view, in my judgment, I see the fruit of the tree and I'm going to take it because that's what looks good to me. And, you know, we've talked about David and Solomon. They make the same mistake. David sees, oh, Bathsheba bathing on the roof. She looks good to me. I'm going to take her. Solomon sees riches and women and frivolities. It looks good to me. I'm going to take it. And what happens at the end of Dune 2? Spoiler. I mean, the book's like 60 years old, so like, but Paul, at the end of the day, he's got all these voices. And what does he turn to? Well, Paul, what looks good to me? He makes the decision that no, I'm going to seize power. I'm going to seize power. And it's not based on necessarily what. Now, again, there's no Christ figure in this story. The only, in many ways, Paul is an antichrist figure.
Right. He's a false
But
Christ.
he's a false Christ and he knows it. But he makes a decision for what's good for him and he takes it rather than basing it on some transcendent principle on what is the right thing to do. He is pragmatist. And that is it's a cautionary warning. Now, for Christians, we can look at this and we can say, what are you basing your decisions on? We're all going to face big decisions. They may not all be whether or not to go to intergalactic war on planet Arrakis, but we're gonna face big decisions in our lives. What is our guiding principle? Is it what is God asked me to do? Or is it what's gonna be good for me? And in many ways, that's what Dune, whether Frank Herbert or Denis Villeneuve, the director of the movie, whether they intended it or not, that is a lesson that Christians can take away from Dune and then enjoy all the sandworms.
Right. You know, one of the things that just really, really caught my attention, both when I was reading the book and when I was watching the film, is the pattern that we see in the Bible of the sins of the father being visited upon the son. And I'll try to be careful not to be too spoiler-ish, but there's a one of the in the first movie, and in the first half of the book, you're in a situation where, because of for political reasons, Leto Atreides, Paul's father, never married Paul's mother, and he did that in order so he could still be an eligible bachelor and could still attract marriage proposals and marriage interest from other noble houses. You know, it's very much a Solomon figure there.
And in Dune 2, Paul is faced with a similar prospect of what do I prioritize? The relationship with the woman I love or politics?
Right. And so that was very interesting to me to see a story that you see play out, you know, similar to a story that you see play out in the scriptures. One of the things that you see happen in David's life story is in the aftermath of the Bathsheba scandal and everything that happens there. His sons make some very poor choices. And one of the reasons you can look at that is because, or you can ask yourself the question, did they grow up watching the way their father handled relationships with women in a less than God-honoring way? One of the
Same thing
things,
happens with Abraham and Isaac.
Abraham and Isaac, because Abraham tried to give Sarah away to get himself out of trouble, not once but twice in the story of Genesis.
And then Isaac does the same thing,
Isaac does
just
the
like
exact
dad.
same thing, just like dad, you know. And so the moral of the story is, again, and I, you know, I've got four kids, so you know, being a dad and trying to teach my kids how to love Jesus is a big part of my life. But so I was really blessed. I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago, and I had a chance to ask in the Q&A. I had a chance to ask Sean McDowell. Sean McDowell was talking about developing a Christian worldview, which is actually something that we're kind of talking about here, was seeing movies and film and art through the lens of a Christian worldview. And I asked Sean McDowell, I said, "How do we as parents pass on a Christian worldview to our children?" And he said, "Step one is have a faith that's worth emulating and live it out." You know, step one of teaching your children to have a Christian worldview and to love Jesus and to think like Christians and approach the world like a Christian and a believer and someone who wants to follow Jesus is follow Jesus yourself. Follow Jesus yourself and then allow them to see that
and then have those conversations with them throughout the normal course of life.
It's an excellent way to live our lives. And, you know, your kids are a bit older than mine. Mine are still toddlers. But, you know, I'm very much aware of that as well. And then also kind of to piggyback on that and to bring it back to movies is that, you know, the way that we engage with the art of our world, to teach others to engage with it similarly, is to engage with it ourselves this way. You know, how do you, if you're concerned, for instance, about the kinds of messages that your kids are receiving from movies and television and that kind of thing, start by asking these kinds of questions yourself. What can we learn about what to do or not to do, how to follow God or not follow God from the kinds of shows we watch, whether it's talking raccoons or sandworms? You know, there are lessons there. And so I would encourage to anybody watching or listening here to be thinking through the messages and the content of the shows that you engage with, or the TV shows or movies that you engage with, and, you know, looking for lessons that you can learn from the art that you can consume. And then similarly, you know, like you do with your kids, is to have conversations with your kids about those lessons, not necessarily in a Saturday afternoon special kind of way, but by practicing it, by doing it yourself, by engaging with this kind of thought as well. And some people say, Dan, is just a movie. And to be fair, there is an element, all right, where you can see a movie and it's just about seeing a car chase or an explosion, and I understand that. However, I do think that this layer opens up another layer of enjoyment for me, because I can enjoy sandworms and knife fights, and then I can also enjoy thinking about, you know, what is this teaching me about power, and what is this teaching me about parenthood? I could do both.
Yeah, I certainly enjoy having those kind of next level conversations about movies and shows that we watch. Just a couple of weeks ago, we watched Loki. It was the second season, right? There were two seasons of Loki.
Season two, yes.
Season two of Loki, and the way the imagery that was involved in the climax and the ending of season two of Loki really reminded me of some of the ways that the gospel authors frame the crucifixion.
Yes. Without getting too much into spoilers, Loki is a self-centered character who, in order to solve all of the timey-wimey timeline multiverse shenanigans, has to make a sacrificial act.
Right.
He has to, rather than being self-serviced, he has to give himself away. Mm-hmm. And intentionally or not, as the filmmakers were depicting, you know, the God of Mischief sacrificing himself on behalf of others, they took a page right out of the God of the Bible sacrificing himself for others.
That's right.
Presenting himself as a living sacrifice. Mm-hmm. You know, greater love hath none other than this, that a man lay his life down for his friends. That is exactly how season two of Loki ends, with him giving himself away. He's this guy, this self-centered guy, who spends the entire series talking about how he has glorious purpose. And it isn't until he stops worrying about himself and starts worrying about other people that he actually gets that glorious purpose, that he fulfills that glorious purpose. His purpose was not to rule and is to be served. His purpose was to serve and lay his life down as a ransom for many.
You know, and I think for those of us, I think those are important words for those of us that are followers of Jesus, you know, is that we want to follow in that same pattern. You know, the Matthew 20:28 says, you know, for the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life ransom for many. And we want to do the same thing. You know, we want to get up in the morning and figure out how we can lay down our life how we can follow in the footsteps of Jesus, so we can follow his example, so that we can sacrifice for the good of our families and our friends and our coworkers and our church.
And, you know, sometimes in movies, we think of the big heroic sacrifice where the guy goes out in a hail of gunfire. But what was so moving about Loki is he makes a sacrifice, but he doesn't die.
That's right.
The sacrifice is a perpetual living sacrifice, which is the sacrifice that we're called to make.
Yeah. You know,
dying is easy, but living is harder.
Dying is easy, but living is hard. We got a Hamilton quote in there. That's awesome.
Yeah, we worked Hamilton in. It's there we go. We're covering our musical theater, our TV, and our movies. There we go.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Anything else we need to talk about before we wrap this up?
I was just going to ask, are there any cinematic projects that are coming up soon that you're really excited about or looking forward to see?
I'm always excited about the next thing that they're going to do in the franchises that I enjoy. I am excited about the next thing that they're going to do with Marvel. I would love to see if they're going to make another Dune movie. There's rumblings. And to bring it back, actually, full circle, the director of Barbie, Greta Gerwig, is working on an adaptation of The Chronicles of Narnia.
I was wondering if we were going to talk about that.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting. In interviews, I have heard her say that she has a lot of respect for, it doesn't seem like it's a paycheck gig for her. She says that she has a lot of respect, not just for C.S. Lewis, the storyteller, but C.S. Lewis, the philosopher and theologian. Mm-hmm. And she is a smart, talented person. So I'm very eager to see what she does with it. I think she's going to surprise people. But we'll see.
Well, and she adapted. I know there's going to be some people that are concerned because of the politics that were present in Barbie, the very overt politics. But also, she adapted Little Women a couple of years ago, and I have not seen that adaptation, but you saw it, and you were very pleased with it.
Yes, I thought it was a wonderful adaptation of Little Women. So, I think if she were to try to make Narnia kind of a contemporary political statement, I think that would be a mistake.
Sure.
But if she were to adapt it the way that she adapted Little Women, which is sort of more honoring the spirit of the property, I think that she might surprise people. And that she's not, you know, as much as it was pink and political, she's got layers. So I'm cautiously optimistic that it might be a really interesting, compelling adaptation of a property that I really love.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. And if it happens, we'll have to get back together and do a podcast about it.
Yeah. I am saying I told you so and not eating crow.
Any final words of encouragement for our listeners as they are thinking about and interacting with the art form that is film?
A lot of times I have seen believers kind of be afraid to engage in culture, because by engaging in culture, they might feel like they're betraying something about being a believer. I don't see a distinction between. I think that someone can just as easily engage in culture, engage in movies, watch movies, enjoy them, discuss them. And I think that you don't have to choose between whether or not you like movies and whether or not you love Jesus. I think you can do both. So that would be my closing comment is, it's okay to love both Jesus and movies.
Love Jesus, love movies, and learn to see movies through the eyes and through the lens of someone who loves Jesus.
Excellently put.
Awesome. Well, Uncle Dan, Brother Dan, Dr. Dan, Professor Dan, thank you so much for joining us again for this episode of the Heights Podcast. Really appreciate you taking the time, and I've really enjoyed this conversation. Just want to remind our audience that at Heights Baptist Church, our mission is to love and to lead all people to a new life with Christ. We worship at our campus that's on the south side of the Houston metro area every Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. We have life groups available for all ages at 9 a.m. And we also stream those services on Facebook and YouTube. We invite you to follow us on social media for this podcast and other content. And if you've got more questions about our church, You can go to heightschurch.org, and we'll see you next time. Hi, Mom.
Hi, Mom.